is the PT Pintcast, a podcast that talks about physical therapy over beer, bringing together clinicians, researchers, and forward-thinking PTs in a show that's anything but boring.
Let there be beer!
This is the PT Pintcast with your host, Jimmy McKay.
Another episode of the PT Pintcast starts right now. The best conversations happen at happy hour. Welcome to ours. Want to thank everybody who's been listening and following us on Facebook, on Twitter, at PT Pintcast. Our guests tonight, I've already had a conversation with one of our guests tonight in a bar, and that's how this got put together. I'm talking to Jessica. She's the Western Carolina University Department of PT, Academic Coordinator of Clinical Ed. Got her BA in Exercise and Sports Science from UNC Chapel Hill and her DPT from Duke. We're going to talk about that, how that played on Tobacco Road. She teaches pediatric content and professional practice courses and is the WCU dance team coach. Todd, professor of physical therapy at WCU, received his physical therapy education from Idaho State University, post-professional DPT from the University of St. Augustine, and post-doctoral research fellowship at the Johns Hopkins University. He teaches orthopedic content and also currently practices at Carolina West Sports Med, and he considers himself a reasonable dancer, but that claim has been repeatedly failed to be supported by direct observation. So Todd Watson and Jessica Graining, welcome to the PT Pintcast.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for having us.
You guys are still at school, so are you guys allowed to have beer on campus? What's the rule?
We're on an undisclosed location.
Gotcha. Okay. So what are we drinking tonight? The hardest question is always first.
Ignore the diploma on the back.
I didn't see anything.
Yeah. I have, it's the Highlands Thunderstruck Coffee Porter.
Really? I have not heard of that, but Thunderstruck is one of my favorite rock tunes.
Highlands is a local Asheville, North Carolina brewery, and quite popular.
Nice. I like it when we stay local with those local brews. And yes. Jessica, what are we drinking?
Right now I'm drinking water.
You're drinking water.
Yes.
That's okay. You got to hydrate before you dehydrate. That's the rule.
Yes. Very true.
I'm going at the suggestion of my roommate. I always try to have a different beer with each episode. The Delirium Tremens out of Belgium.
All right.
All right. So the hard questions are out of the way. Let's get into the fun stuff. So Todd, you and I actually met twice, and I think I was intoxicated both times. This is probably not good for my academic standing, but they were all after hours at conferences.
Yes, and they were both at both next conferences. Mm-hmm. The first time was at the next conference in Charlotte in 2014. It was at a club, quite packed, and I was there with a group of students where we bumped into each other. I forget how we struck up the conversation, but you were like, oh, you're here for the PT conference too, and you were saying how amazing you thought the profession was. The speakers that day had really sort of struck a chord with you, especially the one about the ongoing research looking at getting spinal cord injury kids walking again. And I think, you know, it touched everybody, but you were just amazed at what PTs could do. You said these famous words, PTs make people walk, man.
That sounds like something I would say, so I can't refute that at all.
And then so then when I ran into you the next in National Harbor this last summer, I said, I think I met you before, and I brought this up that we'd met at Charlotte, and you were kind of giving me that sideways look that says, I don't think so. And then when I said, and you told me thing about making people walk, you said, Dad, oh, I guess we did run into each other.
And this was also in a bar. This is the rooftop bar at the Gaylord Hotel at National Harbor. That was a good time. I like both of those conferences.
The first time I went there, it took me 25 minutes to find the place, and I was staying in the hotel.
It's kind of like a hidden elevator.
It is. It is crazy.
So we've met twice over beers, and I remember that second time, probably a little more than I remember the first time, you were talking about some of this research at the next conference in Charlotte is really where the idea for this podcast kind of came about, kind of being inspired by PT and how I can share the message. And I remember you and I connecting like, we should talk about this research you were doing. I'm like, well, that'd be a perfect episode for this podcast that I'm hopefully eventually going to start.
Yes. Yeah. And so Jessica and I share similar backgrounds in that we work down the hall from each other and that we're on the same department of PT, but areas are very different. I do orthopedics and she does pediatrics, but she is the dance team coach, and she'd made a lot of observations with her own dancers that kind of got some ideas kind of spinning around in her head, and she approached me about some ideas, and we got to brainstorming, and then a research project was born.
I think it was more like I came to you with lots of injury and problems that were repeatedly occurring with my team, and you helped me formulate it into a research question.
So the Western Carolina University dance team, and you're coaching that, Jessica, as well as being a faculty member there. And what kind of injuries keep creeping up?
We get a lot of overuse injuries and a lot of injuries related to instability. So coming with lots of questions and suggestions, I try not to wear my physical therapist hat at practice. I try just to be the coach at practice, but also knowing and seeing some of these girls having injuries and suffering and wanting to get them help. So consulted the expert from there. We came up with a really good research question.
And what was that question? What did you guys want to answer with your research?
Centered on this observation that ask any dancer formally trained, that is, do you have to have a strong core to be able to turn well or pirouettes, as they call them, or just to move in space? And they all agreed, yeah, you got to have a really strong core. Then when we started looking into the literature, it's just never really been tested.
It's something like that where it's become fact because you've heard it a million times, and then you go look and realize there's nothing there.
Yeah, so
it's become fact on kind of both ends of the spectrum, from the physical therapy point, but also from the dancer standpoint as well. And they're always talking about getting my core stronger and activating my core, and then you ask them what exercises they're doing, and they just lay down and do 200 crunches. Then you watch them dance and see all these injuries that they're having and look at an unstable core, and you realize that there's a big disconnect. So,
well, this also translates to most orthopedic patients that I was seeing over the summer in an outpatient ortho clinic. We kind of, whenever there was any lumbar back issues, we kind of always went with the core as well. I feel like you can test pretty much anybody off the street and you're going to find some core weakness, as they call it. And we say, well, we got to shore up the core. So you guys got into this and said, all right, well, if that's true, let's find out. So how'd you guys actually do it?
From the beginning, I guess.
Yeah. So we decided we would enroll half the dance team into this study to be in the experimental group, and the other half would be our controls across this 9-week period that was sort of the experimental trial. And during the 9 week, the experimental group, they did this 3-day-a-week, really a progressive but really intense core workout. You test a lot of fatigue tests for the core, lower extremity strength, and static and dynamic balance measures to sort of get baselines on all of their activity performance. And then we also looked at turning, how many turns can they do, pirouettes, and their ability to sort of hold certain dance positions.
Like balance positions.
Balance positions. I don't know all the dance terminology. She knows
that. Was pretty good.
And then we followed this group through the 9 weeks and then retested everybody. Because we're not that particularly large of a school with a large dance team, we still needed more numbers. So this year we went round two and took another cohort into the study. And we're just finishing that up now.
How many people did you have in it total when you had both groups?
20 in the experimental group, and then a number smaller than that in the control group. So, well, we were really excited with what we were seeing, but also there were some surprises that strong core isn't going to fix everything, especially in performance people, because they're already pretty good shape in some ways, you know?
Right, yeah. They're pretty strong. I've seen some dancers, and sometimes they're hot. I'm just saying, most of the time they're pretty hot. Let's just be honest here.
Bendy.
Is that bad to generalize that dancers have attractive bodies? It's not.
Actually, that's one of the things we wanted to look at, because we had some of these instability, hypermobility-related injuries before we even got into things. Ankle instability, back instability, that was, you know, one of the driving things she was mentioning earlier. Yeah, so we looked at their bite and scale, looked at their flexibility, and they're generally, for sure, more bendy than the average person, by far than me, but they were not, as a group, abnormally so, or they were not an 8 or 9 on the Biden scale.
A few outliers, but mostly.
So a collegiate dance team is actually more a special population, different than ballet, different than ballroom. Yes. Does that kind of change what you're looking at?
Yeah, absolutely. And actually doing kind of the background and figuring out really what's out there for dancers, there's nothing for college dancers, collegiate competitive dancers. So you'll find some literature on ballet or kind of the technical studio trained ballet dancers, or even we did find some on ballroom and some other things. But, you know, when you're talking about college dance and competitive college dance, you're really looking at a dancer that needs to be flexible and strong and have good balance and have the aesthetic qualities that you would expect from a studio dancer. But then they also need to be athletic and be able to run, explosive power, and all of those things that don't typically go hand in hand when you're looking at purely ballet trained studio dancers and things like that. So you have to balance a need for flexibility, which often is instability, and the need for stability for a lot of those dynamic and explosive moves that you need. It's tricky.
Was there a video program created for the study over, 9 weeks?
Yes. The control group continued with regular dance team conditioning. So there was a typical time period after practice that there was some sort of conditioning that took place. And we made sure that it was not core specific. It was just kind of general conditioning. And then the experimental group did the 9 weeks of core specific training. It was 2 days a week. We followed a video and we created the video. We have a student group that helped us create the video. So they have a 9 week progressive training program on video. We did it together as a group, the experimental group and myself. And I made sure that they had appropriate form and that they were not doing the tasks incorrectly. And then they were to do the exercise is one additional time during the week on their own following that same video. And then every week they got a new video link and it progressed over the 9 week period.
So you're expecting there to be a translation. So now you've got a population, half of them are not doing anything different than they normally do. Half of them are getting the special treatment. And you're thinking, well, because we've been told a million times that a strong core is needed, what did you start to see?
What we saw after the first year was that one of the dance maneuvers we had them do was a sort of a static single leg balance and passe releve position hold. That didn't change between groups. It was just static balancing. So it didn't affect that. Although there are a number of studies that looked at improving core strength, and in some it looks like you do get better balance out of it. But both groups already had that balance ability. So that was the static. Then we looked at the turns, the turning ability, the pirouettes, the small numbers. We really didn't see a group separation. There was a bit of a trend to that, but we didn't see that. We haven't run the numbers from year two yet, so we'll wait to see on that. The other thing we saw was in some of the maneuvers of, and you might be familiar with this Stark Curzon balance test, the SCBT, which is kind of a dynamic single leg maneuver that does sort of mimic some dance moves, turn in second and a curtsy or something, mm-hmm. if I'm saying that right. Those we definitely saw some group separation improvement. So it looks like the core program is going to improve your dynamic balance, at least in this population of athletes, but I suppose their static balance was already where at a similar level and didn't improve from.
Yeah, these dance moves are a little over my head. I typically do like an awkward like head shake to the side.
Uh-huh. And then that's fine. I got that one.
Uncoordinated hip thing is usually what I do. That's my dynamic. And then I try to stand, I stand near the edge of the dance floor and hope that I don't make eye contact with anybody for fear that they would want to dance with me.
Write that into our next edition of our...
Yes, I can make a video of this. It's not fun. You're seeing not what you necessarily thought, because we've heard core is going to translate, and you tested static and dynamic, and so far with the research that you're getting, it's not there. Does this mean that maybe the core programs down the road for outpatient ortho and back issues and instability, are we doing the right thing, or are we just spinning our wheels?
I don't know if I'd throw the baby out with the bathwater. Fairly fit individuals to start with, so the robust results from these these exercises, I'm sure they're still there in the less fit population, who usually that's who comes through our doors
right.
in the clinic.
A few things that I found pretty interesting was, before we even kind of crunch the numbers, just kind of watching the immediate effect of the training of the activation of the core. So there was another layer to the research project that we didn't really touch on, which was in the first go around in the pre-testing that we did before we did the 9 week intervention, we had them go through a training period where we taught them how to appropriately or correctly contract their transversus abdominis using ultrasound biofeedback, so ultrasound imaging.
Oh, okay.
And so we had them contract their core in a way that they thought they were activating their core. And then we trained them how to correctly do it, gave them biofeedback, and then watched the change in that. So that all happened in the first part of our research. So that improved immediately. Ability to activate improved immediately.
And that was done to both groups?
Yes, to everybody. Okay. Yeah. Everybody had the same. And then we did the same and looked at, now that we taught you immediately how to activate your core, did that affect your turning ability and your balance ability immediately?
And was there any change?
What we
there?
Saw was it destroyed their ability. No, it destroyed their ability. Because you're talking about, some of these dancers have been dancing, they've been dancing for 10 years, maybe competitively, maybe even more. So they had an already completed motor plan for how to do a pirouette. They knew exactly what they had to do to keep their center of balance. And then in teaching them something different, now they're in this dual task area where they're, all right, I'm thinking about my turn differently, and I'm thinking about contracting my core and doing all of these things, and it actually had a negative impact initially. again, that just kind of gave us another kind of layer in how to look at things. And then, you know, the other piece is the research shows that while you need to have a stable core, it needs to be dynamically stable. So it has to be able to adjust to some minor challenges and changes to your center of mass. As you're turning, you're not always going to pirouette exactly on zero. You may kind of fall off center, and you have to be able to have a dynamically responsive and stable core to adjust to those and still keep spinning without toppling. And if you kept a very rigid core and you deviated just a degree out of that, you would fall over. Were they then thinking about keeping it so rigid that they began to topple versus before they were able to kind of adjust a little bit easier, you know, a little bit more natural for them, I guess. Just more questions, I guess.
Right. Now, I know this is a special population with dancers, but that's similar what we use our core in everyday environments. When I turn to put something on the shelf or while I'm running to keep my top two quarters stable, I've seen it with patients who are, I don't know if I'm supposed to use this term, motor morons. They can do something great on a table, and then I ask them to do it while they're walking across the clinic floor. All of a sudden, that goes out the window. Or they have this very awkward look on their face that they're thinking really hard about trying to get that one muscle thing we just taught them to still fly. Right.
We definitely saw the degradation, and once we taught them to do it, they were trying to think about turns. It really, really went out the window. That information in itself can help us as therapists to know that to expect a period where they've got to do those 10,000 repetitions to make it at the automatic level.
Right.
So even if you're not necessarily getting the response that you thought you'd be getting, you're still getting a response. You can kind of look into why you're getting that response. I mean, I bet you didn't think that when you properly taught them to fire their TA that they would actually lose a little bit of dynamic.
Right.
So you're in year two number now, or you're just finished year number two, going to crunch the numbers for that?
Mm-hmm.
What are we looking for in the future? Where do you think you guys are going to take this?
That is a good question. I'm going to leave it up to Coach ultimately. We may just be finding, you know, street dancers.
Oh, good. You know, I think one of the main things that I felt like we really learned from this was there was going into it kind of that the initial data collection, there was a huge variety, obviously, in kind of what everybody's baseline was. And a lot of the dancers were well beyond at baseline, well beyond the abdominal and back strength tests, kind of what you would expect a normal population. So, you know, we really looked to the literature at designed programs, looking at to strengthen the core, looking at a bunch of different populations of athletes, and trying to incorporate what the literature shows and what we know clinically and what we know about dancers in the dance world to identify what exercises really to use in our 9-week program. And I think for some of the dancers, they were very challenging. And I think from day one, they were challenging and they got to progress and it was a nice progression. And for others, I think they were a little bit easier in the beginning, and not until maybe week six did they get to where they were really challenging them. So I think maybe some way to have a more individualized, a set program that's a little more individualizable. I don't even know if that's a word, but being able to kind of max them out, hold it instead of for a minute, hold it as long as you can. So maybe some people can hold it to failure, to fatigue. Maybe tapping into that a little bit more. I think the exercises that we did, that we used, I think were really good and were able to challenge them dynamically and in dance type positions. And then they were able to concentrate on contracting their transversus while doing these moves. So that way it became a little bit more natural when we were doing balance positions or turns, when we could say, okay, now don't forget to activate your core when you're doing these. And then that's when the repetitions come in, is in practice. You know, we're training it in training session and in the core training program itself, but it's coming into practice when they're doing these dance moves. So I think if we can figure out a way to individualize it a little bit more and maybe kind of think about maybe some additional exercises or how to incorporate those into more traditional dance moves and things.
And that's the goal of PT, is how to make it work for that patient.
Sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, how was it going from University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, to get your DPT from Duke University? How'd that work? They let you in at Duke?
I know. Isn't that awful? Well, all my friends disowned me from Chapel Hill, and then I was hazed on a daily basis at Duke. No, I wasn't. They were great. You know, when you're in grad school, you know, you don't know. I don't think I went to any basketball games, mostly because at Duke you have to camp out for like a week to get basketball tickets. So that was pretty challenging. And I was on the dance team at UNC Chapel Hill, so I never had to camp out for tickets. I was courtside all the time. So my loyalties are, I'm at Chapel Hill, so I'm a Tar Heel through and through. I did have another classmate who also graduated from Chapel Hill, so we kind of a little bit more strength in our numbers. But
and just looking forward, Todd, the next convention is coming up in Nashville.
Down by
Absolutely.
Us.
Yeah, if yes. we could if we could get drunk in a bar at the next convention, it would be three in a row. I'm just saying, that's we kind of have a thing going on here.
We need the three-peat.
I like that. Well, hey, we're looking forward to hearing what you guys have coming up. You guys are just getting done with year number two and crunch those numbers. We'll see where this thing goes, and we'll check back in with you guys to see what's up with the competitive dance team. And if you guys need any hands or help, you know, I'll be graduating soon. It's a short drive away.
Yes.
Sounds good.
When we're done with an episode, and before we let you guys go, we try to do some shots.
Okay.
So parting shots. So if you were to give a little piece of advice to either a graduating PT or a newly graduated PT, what's something you want them to stick in their ear or just take an ounce and a half up? What's a good parting shot?
I would say for new grads, you only know half as much what you think you do, so take twice as long to learn it.
Oh my gosh, that was really good.
Okay.
Oh my goodness, what is something?
What was something that you would have wanted to tell your Duke self that you know now that you didn't know back when you were at Duke?
Keep seeking out the knowledge and finding your niche and finding the things that just make you light up and kind of keep you going, because there's so much more information out there beyond PT school.
Yeah, so every time I learn one thing, I realize there's 10 more things I need to know now, and that number keeps multiplying. My reading list just keeps getting longer and longer. I keep bookmarking a lot of things, and eventually when I'm done with school, I'll get to it.
It's overwhelming in school, absolutely, but once you get out, you can really kind of pave your way, and it's very cool.
Yeah, there's a light at the end of the tunnel. I'm not sure if it's the end of the tunnel or if it's a train coming my way. I'm not sure. Could be either one. Want to thank you guys for being on the PT Pinecast. Thanks to Todd Watson and Jessica Groening from Western Carolina University, the Department of Physical Therapy. Guys, thanks for taking some time out and telling us about your research.
Absolutely.
Working at his orbicularis oris until failure. DJ, Jimmy McKay on the PT Pinecast.
All right, the best conversations happen at happy hour. Welcome to ours. Another episode recorded, this one in person. I like when we have the live interviews. Just down the street from where I live, it is Rockland's Barbecue and Grilling Company. You know it's a good bar and barbecue place when, on Monday nights, if you order a beer, any beer, you get a free chopped pork sandwich with the beer. So I'll give this guy his dues. On the show today, he's a board-certified orthopedic clinical specialist, PT, that specializes in bike fitting. Yeah, my ears went up when we got to talking a couple months ago. Currently working on establishing a presence amongst the cycling community to entrust PTs for the care and making them efficient and, importantly, pain-free on and off the bike. Actively involved in providing quality, affordable, cash-based PT care to soccer and baseball youth athletes here in Northern Virginia. An alum of my current school, Marymount University, on the PT Pinecast is Kerr Son. Kerr, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
All right. We met a few months ago. We were doing PT Day of Service, and one of my professors says, hey, if there's anybody out there who can help out, we've got an alum who's coming to school, going to use the facilities, do some bike fitting. And I was like, whoa, right here. I'm raising the hand right here. And that was cool because as a triathlete, I know the importance, but I'm a college student.
Of course.
And I'm just like, well, I'll just do it myself. So I want to thank you for introducing that to me on PT Day of Service, and we got a chance to work with some people in the local community, and it was a cool way also to expose people who wouldn't necessarily think of PTs in that sort of role as a preventative role to us. So thank you for that.
Of course.
For being on the show, now that we got this, you got your alma mater logo, Pint Glass.
Oh, my goodness.
And on the back is the PT Pintcast logo, and you're welcome.
Oh, thank you.
So we'll drink out of that. So first question is always the hardest. What are we drinking this evening?
Drinking good old Miller Lite.
American-made Miller Lite.
American-made, yep.
I went with the White Rascal Belgian-style white ale from the Avery Brewing Company in Boulder, Colorado.
Nice.
So cheers to you, Kerr, and welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Want to make sure people can get a hold of you if they have any questions or they like what they hear.
Sure.
You're on the Twitter at VeloFitPT.
VeloFitPT, yep.
On Twitter and website VeloFitPT.com. It's all about bike fitting. I'm interested in it because after school I wouldn't mind maybe doing this either full-time or maybe something on the side. It just sounds cool. So how'd you get into bike fitting and cycling specifically? Was it your passion or did you fall into it?
So it was my passion 10 years ago, right out of school. I was trying to figure out a way to combat all the stresses of PT school. And
yeah, there's a couple.
There's a couple, yeah. So Marymount, yeah, that was going through a first year doctorate program.
Right.
So a lot of transition. So I got into cycling with my classmate and just kind of fell in love with it. You know, just the whole social aspect, trying to get it to know people, riding with groups. So it was immediate. I just loved it. Then social media started kind of popping up into the cycling community. Strava came onto the scene.
Right.
I love using social media. So that kind of took it to another level because you got the competitive, kind of the edge.
So just explain to some people out there, I know what Strava is, but explain to some people who might not.
So Strava is basically a social media platform where cyclists create routes along any route that on any road, and it gives you kind of rankings on how fast you compete against.
So similar to like, you know, I would explain it to one of my buddies is like similar to like map my run or map my ride. You use that. Someone sets up a route, you see it and say I could do that a little faster, and it times you versus other people.
Yep, exactly. It makes it a little less soreness on the saddle and the torture that you're going through. So it breaks it up a little bit.
Yeah, it makes it a little interactive too.
Yes, exactly.
That's cool. So getting into cycling in PT school, that was the first time you ever really ridden a road bike or got into it?
So I got into mountain biking first, injured myself several times. So it made me quickly transition to road biking. So after that, I just, you know, it was a little safer for me, protect my career.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So when did you start to think about, hey, this is a spot, was it the injuries? This is a spot where PT can intervene and make some progress.
Yeah, that came more in the latter half of, you know, my PT years. It's interesting because this past summer, when I transitioned out of my role as a PT in a spine setting, went off on my own, it gave me this platform to kind of do what I wanted to do. And I've always kind of tinkered with the idea of trying to introduce bike fitting or doing something in that realm. And so this was like kind of the perfect opportunity just to kind of do what I loved.
Right.
I said, why not? Just try it out, you know?
Yeah.
I figured there's a market for it.
Oh, yeah.
And I always thought about it, and I kind of had the concept, but I tried it out and kind of dabbled in it, and it was like a light bulb that went off.
Yeah, I mean, when we were doing the event that you had set up for PT Day of Service, we had a full room, and people were still showing up.
It was crazy.
We had more bikers than we could handle that day.
Yeah, it was crazy.
We do that again next year. We're going to wrangle some more PT students.
Yeah.
As a weekend warrior, age group triathlete, and a PT student, correct me if I'm wrong. So I'm thinking bike fitting and PT, you're trying to make sure the bike fits the person better than the person goes ahead and tries to fit the bike.
Yes.
Which is what we always try to do.
Yeah,
we try to adapt to the bike.
Exactly. Yeah, and so we suffer and we figure that's part of cycling or triathlons, learn behavior to like just suffer through it.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of the mentality of all the cyclists and triathletes.
I was taught in PT school, whenever you're going to compare two different things, whether they be different styles like Maitland, McKenzie, bike fitting, running eval, bike fit to physical therapy evaluation, where are the similarities and where are the differences? That's what I was always taught to look for.
Sure. I think the biggest similarity is that you are trying to position the patient in the best position to perform without injuring themselves.
Okay.
And I think the whole evaluation of the body and making sure that biomechanics are correct and that you are trying to adapt that body to the bike and the bike to the body is kind of where PTs play that crucial role.
Yeah.
And so it's that link that traditional bike shops usually don't have, you know?
Right.
You have the local bike shop fitter, and nothing against them, but they don't have the anatomical and physiological knowledge that we do. There's that link that people are craving and very new, you know? And especially in the East Coast, I think we're a little late to adapt to things. West Coast is a little bit more forefront of that.
So they're already doing that.
Yeah, I think it's a little bigger, definitely on the West Coast. Yeah.
Seems like a big opportunity, though.
Yeah, definitely.
Because in the clinic, I'll suggest if someone's having pain running and they still want to keep active while they're healing, I'll say, hey, why don't you jump on a bike?
Yeah.
And it is a good time. People do get hooked.
For sure.
And these bikes aren't cheap. So if you're going to you're gonna drop some coin, you're going to drop $1,000 on a bike. You want the thing to fit.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, it's like going to a tailor, you know, going to a suit, getting a tailor
made.
Getting
a nice suit.
Yeah, getting
absolutely.
A suit on. Yeah.
So personal question, what do you ride?
I ride currently a Specialized S-Works, kind of upgraded a little bit last year. When I started to kind of dive into this, I figured...
Well, now you can write it off. Now you can write it off.
Write it off.
It's a
business expense.
I mentioned this before in a previous episode. I feel like I stole this bike from this guy on Craigslist.
Yeah,
I don't think he knew what he had.
Yeah.
And I got myself... It was kind of like my dream bike because I'm in PT school. I don't have any money.
Yeah.
Did a bunch of swim lessons, made a bunch of money, found a Cervelo P2 trial bike online, got it. And literally as I'm walking out of there, I turned to the girl that was with me. I was like, get in the car right now because he's going to change his mind. So it's cool when you find one that you really like, and you want to make sure it fits, and you want to make sure, man, if I'm paying $1,000, $2,000,
you better get it fit. Yeah,
you better get it fit to you. So walk me through what's a bike fit PT evaluation look like or feel like.
So the biggest thing is that obviously, as a PT, you are going through subjective of objective exam. and you want to make sure that the client has the flexibility and mobility to tolerate the positions that they're seeking. So a time trialist and a triathlete is going to seek for a little bit more aggressive position, but at the same time, you don't want to hurt them. And a lot of people are, like I said, in the mindset of, I got to just suffer through it. I got to get through this leg of the triathlon and just get to the next thing. I find more and more that comfort trumps aerodynamics any day. If you can get the person happy on the saddle, on the bike, they're gonna love it. They're gonna enjoy it. That goes the same across professional athletes or the person that kind of does the weekend warriors.
Yeah. So you look at the person first, subjective, you're checking range of motion, checking strength. So far, it sounds like a PT eval.
Yeah, just like a PT eval.
But then some mechanical stuff comes into it because now you have a bike. So you have to be really, really knowledgeable in terms of a bunch of different bikes.
Yes. You have to be knowledgeable of the components, just like, you know, the human body. But there is that aspect of, you definitely have to know how to switch stems, adjust things, take proper measurements of the bike.
Right. And be able to talk the talk, because the person who's standing there, you know, willing to pay you.
Of course.
About it is going to want to make sure that you know what you're talking about in terms of bike to bike.
Yep.
We get the range of motion, we get the strength, we get the subjective, we throw them on a trainer and we're watching. What are we looking for?
First, we're asking whether they're having any pain or issues on the bike. A lot of times you get to a point where they don't even think about it usually, and then you ask them and kind of poke and prod, and they're like, oh yeah, I do kind of hurt after a couple miles, or there's a certain spot that's a really hot spot, maybe my foot, in my cleat, or in my saddle, my hands, and you kind of get that and question them, and they kind of give you these answers right away, and so you're looking at whether their position fits these ideal or optimal angles, but that's not the end all. That's where the creative PT kind of comes into play. If there's biomechanical issues there, we gotta focus on that and see a way that we can adjust to make sure that the person's comfortable on the bike.
It seems like it'd be a good opportunity, because a lot of times, I know when I do an eval for running, person runs in front of me on a treadmill, completely different than they're gonna run out on the road.
Sure.
Is a trainer to out on the road similar, better, worse, what?
So yeah, definitely being on the trainer is definitely different, because you're not going through the whole incline or decline or rocking of the bike on the trainer, so it's completely different. But at the same time, you can at least get the static measurements and then kind of go from there and then work on some dynamic stuff. I have a compu trainer that I kind of use sometimes that gives them some resistance to kind of simulate. But again, it comes down to them getting on the road. And I always give a client a chance to kind of test it out, because you got to really, the fit is, if it's going to change a little bit, you have to really have a real life situation on the road to come back to me and give me some feedback.
Absolutely.
I always give that opportunity.
So you're looking at them, you using any video time? I've seen some people use a little video.
Using video, yep. Definitely using the video. Just get to pre-bike fit, post-bike fit. Make sure that they understand where they are. They can see the actual differences. And I always use the front view. And the way that I was taught as far as the methodology was, we're looking at the front view, making sure that the knee and the foot pedal interface is optimal. So if you don't get that, there's a lot of things that can go wrong.
Because you know, valgus knee or something.
Yeah, valgus knee, huge. So what happens is that you're going through, 40,000 pedal strokes during a century? That's a lot of strokes. So it puts a lot of wear and tear on your joints.
A lot of opportunity for failure, for compensations, and then pain. And then worst case scenario, the person doesn't want to ride anymore. And that's the ultimate goal, is to make sure they want to stay on that bike.
Sure.
What about length of time? How long are you spending looking at this?
I am usually spending at least 2 hours.
Wow. So that's a little different.
It's a little different. Yeah, so it's quite extensive, and I try to do as much as I can to kind of give them an opportunity to succeed off the bike too. You know, if I see some biomechanical issues off the bike, I'm certainly going to address it.
Right.
And so I always try to incorporate that in. They're going to want to trust you if they see something that you see off the bike. And they're going to be like, okay, I can see this PT again for this issue. And it's one of those things that kind of feeds into itself. It's that whole wellness aspect that PTs are kind of at the forefront for.
Yeah, I like when I saw that on your website, on and off the bike, that it's a big deal. I don't want you just feeling good there. I'm a PT. Yeah. I'm a movement expert.
Exactly.
I'm a movement expert with wheels, or take those wheels out of the way. Yep. And I still know where all the parts are and where they should be.
Yep.
That's cool. Favorite place to ride? Somebody told me you got a really epic ride, maybe overseas.
Yes.
How was that?
So my wife and I decided to splurge, even though we didn't have the money to do it.
And so that's the best time to do it.
That's the best time to
treat yourself.
Yep. Treated ourselves and dropped off the kids, and we went by ourselves to Barcelona, Spain.
Nice.
It was amazing. That was probably, you know, I should say that being with my wife the whole time was the favorite part of the trip.
Best part, right.
Best part of the trip, by far. But it had to be the epic bike ride that I had.
So did you rent bikes? Did you bring them with you?
I rented a bike. I did all the research.
Yeah.
And rented a sweet bike that you can only get in Europe. Got all the gear. Decided that I'm going to take off 7 a.m. in the morning. Did a self-guided route through the mountains. I can't tell you how epic that was.
Yeah.
It was a little rain. At the beginning of the hill, I ran into a pack of wild boar. I kid you not.
Okay.
So I've never had this experience before, but literally I saw on the side of the hill a pack of probably 30, 40 wild boar running down the hill.
That's not what you want to see when you're in
the
bike.
No, and I literally had to cut through these baby boar. I don't know if that's a proper term.
Boarlets.
Boarlets.
I don't know, piglets.
Yeah. I had to weave through and I saw the mama boar looking to charge right at me. Like, needless to say, I was booking it.
A little motivation to pick it up.
So
the wife doesn't ride. She wasn't riding with you that day.
No, she was sleeping.
Yeah, well, she was smart. She wasn't getting attacked by boar.
Probably the most epic ride I had. I ended up in some random village, drank the best coffee I've ever had. Had jamon, the local meat. It was just, I can't even describe that.
That's cool. Yeah, I've talked to a bunch of people who've done rides over in Europe. They've done similar destination rides, and they say it is a unique way to experience a place.
Oh, definitely.
When you see it from two wheels versus, you know, the back of a car or a bus or just hiking around inside the cities is great. You know, hoofing it, but getting out into the suburban and the rural areas is really cool too. And you can cover a lot of ground on a bike, obviously.
You do, and that's probably the most ridiculous amount of climbing I've done.
Yeah.
But I did not feel it at all because I was just so amped up.
Just hyped to be there. Yep. That's cool. All right, so you're out on your own now. We're going to get into the kind of model that you're using in case anybody's interested in terms of cash base and getting out there. But where does that start? So I don't want to talk about how you get the word out and who you have to talk to, because now you got to interface.
Yes.
You got to get the go-between, which is the bike shops and the group rides. And, and how does that work?
Believe it or not, Strava has been, again, I bring up Strava because it's been my marketing tool.
Okay.
I did not intend it for it to be. Last summer, I randomly met up with this guy. I beat his King of the Mountain on Strava. He got his notice and he wanted me to meet up with him. And he rode with me, built up with me doing group rides. The social aspect kind of got things started, and they, you know, naturally it comes up like, oh, what do you do? I'm a PT. Oh, by the way, I kind of do some bike fitting on the side.
Huh?
Things have been kicking up from that. You meet so many people when you're doing group rides, and it naturally just comes up.
That's essentially how I ultimately got into to PT school.
Yeah.
Was training for a tri, knew I needed a ride, knew I wouldn't ride alone, went to a bike shop, and I said, we're at one of the group rides. I say, out at this pizza place at Harvey's Lake in Pennsylvania, and I started riding with a bunch of guys who were I had no business riding with these guys, way faster than me.
Yeah.
And along one of those rides, one of these guys by the name of John started talking, you know, just shooting the breeze, and he's a PT, and he starts talking, and I'm like, you know what, that sounds
inspired,
cool. Next thing you know, a couple years later, I'm in PT
school.
Wow,
so nice.
Cycling brings everybody together.
It's awesome.
So you really leverage social media, which was directly related to cycling, which you were going to do.
Yep.
What else can you do? I mean, do you work directly with bike shops? Are they pro or anti, or bike fitters? Are they pro or anti you?
I'm still figuring that out.
Okay.
I think that is a hard market because the local bike shops have, obviously they have the market as far as bike fitting and stuff like that. So I'm trying to do it in a way that they don't feel threatened. And I think there's definitely a way for us to work together. I think I am trying to gain the trust of people. I don't find me going to a bike shop and saying, oh, look, I'm a bike fitter, you can send people my way. That doesn't usually work. It just turns them off. And so I have to respect the bike shops and what they do. I don't have the technical and mechanical knowledge that they do. I have the basics and I can do what I need to do. But I am looking for a bike shop where I can really just send clients to, and they can kind of, we can mutually work with each other.
That's tough, especially when you're breaking out and you're going out and you're doing it on your own.
Yeah.
So let me ask you this, because I have no idea. Is bike fitting a similar certification to something like a CSCS, or is it kind of a weekend course?
It's like a weekend course.
Okay.
So there's different groups that do the bike fitting.
Different certifications and what? Okay.
And so there's a couple out in Seattle, and it's specifically for clinicians, PTs.
It's
so
even that specific.
It's awesome. I definitely loved it.
Cool. I just think it's another opportunity out there,
yeah.
especially because in Northern Virginia where we are,
yeah.
triathlon is a huge sport.
It's huge.
Cycling is huge.
Yep.
I mean, I see people on the trails around here all year long.
Yeah, yeah.
Ski mask on. They don't care. So it's a big opportunity, you know, in big metro areas for PTs to kind of say, hey, we're movement experts. You're moving. Come and see us for this.
Yeah.
So every episode is a pint, but before we're done with the pint, and we're almost done with our beers, we take shots.
Nice.
Parting shots.
Uh-huh.
So any words of wisdom that you would have for a PT out there who is looking to either, you know, do something similar to you, either some bike fitting, since that's kind of your niche, that's your thing.
Sure. I'd say you have to be where the market is.
Get in their way.
Get in their way. Just be present. That says enough. And being there and just being social and making friends, and they'll automatically seek for you. They'll seek for your skill set, niche that you're looking for. You're gonna be there, and they'll want your services.
Yeah.
And just go for it.
Yeah. Just make sure people know what PTs are, what PTs do, and let's educate them on what we're able to provide for them.
Yep.
Awesome. Exactly. Good words of advice. Kersan, again, the website is velofitpt.com at velofitpt on Twitter. Appreciate you being on the show, man.
Of course. Thank you.
Follow us on Twitter at PTPintcast and online at PTPintcast.com. It's like TMZ, except with way more important information. And no Miley Cyrus. Okay, it's not like TMZ at all. The PT Pintcast is intended for educational purposes only. No clinical decision-making should be based solely on one source. While care is taken to ensure accuracy, factual errors can be present. Our lawyers made us read that.